There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, which is a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's extensive and seemingly accelerating legal issues. They're complicated, and they bring up really good questions about things like how much you have to cooperate with prosecutors to get your own sentence reduced, and about whether you can develop such a reputation as a liar that more lies don't even anger a judge more at the margin when the judge is sentencing you. And questions about what it takes to get Michael Avenatti off television. It was clear we needed to devote some time at least once a week to answering these questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles, and he was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Josh.
So we're taping this on Wednesday, and just this morning, Michael Cohen has been sentenced to 36 months in prison for tax and bank fraud and making an illegal contribution to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. He was also sentenced to 2 months for lying to Congress, but those 2 months will be served concurrently with the 36 months. It doesn't add more time. The illegal campaign contribution, as we all know, was that hush payment to Stormy Daniels that set in motion a great many things in America, including this very show. Ken, first, I want to congratulate you, since you predicted this sentence on the nose, that it would be 36 months. How did you know we were going to end up here?
It's just a sense of these after doing them for 25 years. You start to pick up the rhythm and a sense of a judge is going to reward somebody. How much is it going to be? So it was a bit of a guess, but you see enough of them and it starts to become clear.
So Cohen did get rewarded for his cooperation, but not without a lot of criticism from prosecutors and also from the judge on the bench in the process of handing down the sentence for essentially cooperating incompletely, deciding that there were some topics he would cooperate with prosecutors from the Southern District of New York about, others that he wouldn't discuss, he wouldn't enter into a formal cooperation agreement. How come he got so much credit despite the fact that he basically broke the rules about how you're supposed to be a cooperating witness?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that although the Southern District of New York was very vexed with him and upset that he did not cooperate properly, meaning coming in and answering everything and doing whatever they wanted. The special counsel's office was very complimentary of him and signaled very strongly before the judge, as they did in their brief, that this is very big stuff, that this is somebody implicating the president of the United States, and that's cooperation that is worth an unusual amount. The other reason that he got this fairly significant break, and the judge calculated his guideline range to be 51 months or more and took him down to 36 months. So, that's more of a year of a break. It's not insignificant. The system relies on this. As it currently runs, it can't operate unless you give cooperators incentives to cooperate and give people incentives to plead guilty. If you stopped giving fairly generous incentives, they'd stop doing it and everything would grind to a halt. So that's sort of the institutional pressure that judges are under in this situation.
There was a prosecutor who spoke critically of Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen also spoke on his own behalf at this hearing, which is interesting because Michael Cohen is not necessarily known as the most adept speaker.
Says who?
So how did Michael Cohen's comments in his own defense go?
Well, I'm sure that his lawyers were on the very edges of their seats. This is one of the most grueling moments for a criminal defense attorney because it's when, however much you've prepared your client for the moment, in the heat and emotion of the moment, they can just blow it all by speaking from their heart and, starting to talk about how this is all, it's unfair and they've been unjustly accused and all this sort of thing. And every criminal defense attorney has seen a client absolutely ruin a sentence by going off the deep end during this moment. Cohen did okay. His attempt to point the finger very strongly at the president, and he really made it sound as if he was a perfect guy until he started following Donald Trump. On the one hand,
he said that the president had put him in like a figurative prison by causing him to be so devotedly loyal to the president.
Exactly. And he called out one of the president's tweets saying that he was weak by saying that he was only weak to the extent he was loyal to Donald Trump. So on the one hand, it emphasized how important his cooperation against the president is. On the other hand, it came off as sort of minimizing his own responsibility and his crimes. Clearly, it didn't sink him too much. I don't think it's the case that the judge was about to give him 2 years and gave him three instead because of his speech. It wasn't a terrible one. It wasn't a great one. It was fairly heartfelt, and it was mostly notable for how strongly and bitterly he pointed the finger at Donald Trump as the person who, you know, was the author of his downfall.
When you say you don't think the judge altered the sentence based on Cohen's own remarks here, do judges, I mean, are they swayed by the oral arguments in these proceedings at all? Presumably, don't they come in with a plan about how they're going to sentence the defendant based on the guidelines and the written briefs they've received and their own view from presiding over the case if there's been a trial? Do they actually sit there, listen to these arguments, and then decide on the spot what the sentence is going to be?
They don't decide on the spot. They do come in with a plan, but that plan can be changed. It can be changed by exceptionally good oral advocacy, argument about the technical aspects of the guidelines, or very moving arguments about the client and the background and his remorse. And they can certainly be changed for the worse. And I have seen people get up after pleading guilty and accepting responsibility and basically take it all back and talk about how they're the victim. And you can see the judge's face just change and see them drop the hammer where they were going to be more lenient. So it's easier to make the sentence worse live than it is to make it better, but it does happen.
So does Cohen go to prison immediately? How does this work? And a three-year sentence, does it actually mean he serves 3 years? What kind of facility is going to be in? What's next for Michael Cohen?
Well, he was given a surrender date, which is fairly typical for a white-collar criminal who's been out on bail already. He's going to surrender March. That's not unusual. He will spend 85% of that sentence actually in prison. In the federal system, you get credit for up to 15% for good behavior. So he likely will earn that, assuming he doesn't join some sort of fixer gang in prison. And where he serves will depend on the bureaucracy of the Bureau of Prisons, but he's likely to do it at what is sometimes derisively called Club Fed, one of the minimum security type institutions for white-collar criminals, where people go if they have no record and their crime doesn't involve violence or drugs or anything.
What do you make of, you have Cohen's lawyer and representative, Lanny Davis, famous as Bill Clinton's PR representative during the Monica Lewinsky saga. He's been out there saying that Michael Cohen is going to be a John Dean figure by the end of this, and that he's prepared to tell everything about Donald Trump to Congress, but only after Mueller is done with his investigation. Does this mean anything?
Cohen, and by extension his lawyers, have been cagey about this from the beginning. It's reflected in the fact that he didn't cooperate normally. Again, when you cooperate with the government, you're supposed to go in, put it all on the table, answer any question, do whatever they want, or you're not supposed to go in at all. And Cohen's not doing that. He's answering what he wants to answer. So this thing about how he'll tell you even more, but only at the right time, is sort of more drama-seeking, and I think it's part of Cohen's attempt to reinvent himself and come up with a new arc for his story, going from the powerful fixer who could throw threats of defamation at journalists to the guy telling about how it all went wrong.
This all feels to me like it's been pretty fair to Michael Cohen. Does that sound right to you? I mean, I feel like a lot of what's gone on here has been, to some extent, members of the political elite, the conservative political elite, learning how the federal criminal prosecution process can be unfair to people, basically creating crimes by putting them in situations where they lie, even where the government can't prove an underlying crime. It doesn't feel to me like any of that happened to Michael Cohen. It looks like he engaged in serious criminal wrongdoing, that he basically had an attitude in his business that legal compliance was optional, framed himself as a fixer. You're only a fixer if you're trying to get things you're not entitled to. And while he did plead guilty on a lying charge, it looks to me like the lies that he told to Congress were both willful and material. So it looks to me like Cohen is basically getting what he deserved, and the system has worked in a way that is fair and appropriate here. Would you agree with that?
I would. I mean, the criticism of the system is that it so rarely punishes people who commit crimes in this sector, who commit white-collar crimes, crimes related to tax fraud and bank fraud and people like that, and it's much more likely to treat you harshly if you commit a street crime. So Cohen can complain that he got struck by lightning and that very few people get punished for what he did, but he's right in the middle of how people get punished when they do get prosecuted for this sort of thing. The sentence he got, the types of things he was charged with, are all the types of things I'd be worried about for any client who was caught doing this sort of thing when the U.S. Attorney's Office decided to devote its resources to them. And you're absolutely right about the lying, too. In other words, it's a sharp contrast we saw with General Flynn in his case. We saw a sentencing memorandum from him this week on Tuesday where he was complaining basically that the FBI just walked into his office. No one told him he was in danger. No one warned him that lying would be a crime, and he just sort of fell into it. Cohen, it's a very sharp contrast. He coordinated, he circulated his planned lies, and then he went right up and lied to Congress, both in writing and in front of Congress live. And that's very planned out and very unlike some of the foolish lying in the heat of the moment during an FBI investigation we've seen in some of these cases.
We also learned on Wednesday that American Media, which is the company that owns the National Enquirer, has entered into a non-prosecution agreement with prosecutors from the Southern District of New York. AMI admitted that they made a payment for the purpose of suppressing another story from a woman who alleges that she had an affair with President Trump. That's Karen McDougal. In exchange for not being prosecuted for buying McDougal's story for the purpose of preventing its publication, AMI has admitted its responsibility. They've assisted the Southern District of New York in its investigation into related matters, and they've agreed to implement procedures to prevent themselves from doing things like this in the future and to cooperate in future investigations. So what is the upshot of this? Because there were a lot of people other than Michael Cohen and other than the corporation American Media who were involved in these schemes to conceal these stories. If AMI has been cooperating, is it likely that that's just with regard to Cohen? Or because it feels to me like there's a whole host of other people who could conceivably be charged with crimes here, up to and including Donald Trump if he were to be charged with a crime, say, after he left office.
Absolutely. It could be anyone from the Trump organization to people within the Trump organization or campaign who helped approve these payments or helped make this work. It appears from media reports that people within AMI were also given a walk, were given a immunity or a non-prosecution agreement.
Most notably, David Pecker, the president of American Media.
Exactly. And that's big news because it's not too common for the U.S. Attorney's Office to hand out straight non-prosecution agreements. They're much more likely to make you plead to something and take the felony and then use that as a hammer over you so that you're trying to work off your sentence. So when they give you a straight-up walk, it means that they think you have something of great value to them. Here, the great value is obviously the implication of the President of the United States. And this announcement of their cooperation and description of it is very much calculated to state a case for campaign finance fraud by the highest people in the Trump campaign, including the president. It's designed to sort of rebut all of the talking points we've been hearing, the references to the unsuccessful prosecution of John Edwards that fell apart, things like that. It's basically a shot across the bow saying, you know, we have you on this.
Let's talk about Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort is on his way to being sentenced for his own crimes. There was a court hearing this week before Judge Amy Berman Jackson in Washington, D.C. The hearing regarded a memo that prosecutors filed on Friday in which they alleged that Manafort had breached the terms of his cooperation agreement by repeatedly lying to federal investigators. Manafort's attorney's strategy in this hearing on Tuesday was interesting. They didn't even suggest that they would necessarily contest prosecutors' allegations that Manafort had breached his cooperation agreement. Isn't that a little bit odd? Isn't the cooperation agreement sort of an important thing for Manafort as he tries to get any kind of break on his sentence? They're really just going to sort of walk on this idea that, yeah, our client's a big liar who lied about a bunch of stuff that was material?
No, this is absolutely the smartest stance for the Manafort attorneys to take. Because you've got the government clearly is not going to recommend any credit for cooperation and is going to argue against it. They're furious at him. And you've got them making all these accusations of lying. And what happened at the hearing was the judge said, well, you're going to have to document this. I can't rule based on this fairly vague accusation that he's lying. And Manafort's attorney said, well, let's see. You know, we may not contest that these were lies if it doesn't impact the sentence. And it might not. The reason is a little obscure. He's already agreed that his sentencing guidelines calculations get a bump up for his prior obstruction of justice. So more obstruction in the form of lying might not have an impact on his calculated guideline sentence. And Manafort's attorneys are playing this very smart. The reason is this: to hope that he will ever get out of federal prison alive, they have to try to convince the judge to be lenient and go below the recommended guideline sentence. They have to count on mercy and proportion and that type of thing. And the last thing you want in that sort of circumstance is to have the judge going through a whole bunch of evidence about how you're a liar and you lied to the government even after you promised to cooperate, and then turn to your sentencing, because that puts the judge in the absolute wrong frame of mind. It has the judge focusing on, you know, the bad things you did and how you're a liar and how you're not deserving of credit, and then turn around to hear your argument about mercy. So what they're doing is this: they're cutting their losses and making the best of a terrible situation and saying, we don't want this judge focusing on whether or not he lied as the live issue when it comes time to his sentencing.
So Manafort's lawyers will have to tell Judge Berman Jackson by January 7th whether they intend to contest the government's allegations that he breached the cooperation agreement, and then there's a hearing on that set for January 25. Manafort was charged in two different federal districts. So this is the Washington, D.C. charges. There are also there was the whole trial that he went through in Virginia where he was convicted on 8 of 18 counts. And in that case, there's supposed to be a sentencing on February 8th. So how do these two spats interact? If Manafort was breaching his cooperation agreement with regard to the District of Columbia charges, does that also influence his sentencing in Virginia? And will they add those sentences together? Do they have to have two sets of hearings on all this stuff?
Well, there do have to be two sets of hearings, absent a very rare transfer of the case from one district to another. I suspect that the judge in Virginia will trail those proceedings behind what's going on in D.C. And they are interrelated to the extent that if he doesn't get credit for cooperating in D.C., he's not going to get any credit in Virginia. The calculation for how these sentences mesh together and whether or not they're consecutive or concurrent, that is, you know, whether you stack them on top of each other or run them at the same time, is all very arcane under the sentencing guidelines. But I think the real action is going to be with the judges, whoever sentences first, that judge's exercise of discretion, whether or not to hammer him with the really quite long sentence he's facing under the guidelines.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about Jerome Corsi, who has an entertaining new lawsuit. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. We talked on this show last week about conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi, who publicly rejected a plea deal with Robert Mueller's prosecution team, and who we therefore think is likely to be indicted sooner or later as part of the whole Russiagate mess. Corsi had gotten himself in the news with what he and his lawyer Larry Klayman called a criminal complaint against Robert Mueller. Basically, this so-called criminal complaint is a letter. It's a letter like any person could send to the Justice Department with a list of complaints about Mueller's behavior and how he's been so unfair to Jerome Corsi. Now Corsi has filed a lawsuit. Ken, can you describe who he's suing and what he's suing them about?
It might be quicker to say who he's not suing, but I mean, he's suing Robert Mueller, Special Counsel's Office, the Department of Justice, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the National Security Agency. And it's the type of set of defendants that you normally see in handwritten things filed from prison. He's enlisted, of course, attorney Larry Klayman, who is the person you would go to for this sort of thing, previously famous for suing President Obama on the theory that he was conspiring against white people by bringing Ebola into the United States. And it's a bizarre lawsuit. Really, it's arguing that the special counsel has violated his Fourth Amendment rights through surveillance. It's a little vague about that. It sounds as if he thinks that the special counsel's office got some of his phone records and other digital information, and also that they're trying to coerce him into making false statements against President Trump by threatening him with a long sentence. It's also accusing the special counsel of leaking grand jury information. And it's really more of a publicity stunt, I think, than a serious lawsuit.
Does the lawsuit matter? Is it likely to affect the way that Robert Mueller approaches a possible indictment of Corsi, for example?
No, I don't think it does. I think he's still going to do whatever he does with Corsi on his own schedule. Strategically for Corsi is extremely foolish because, you know, when you're a target of an investigation, they can't make you come in and testify. You have a Fifth Amendment right. You don't have to answer questions. You don't have to, you know, respond in writing or any of that. But when you voluntarily bring a lawsuit, then you're subject to discovery. They can force you to sit for a deposition. They can force you to answer written questions and answer things all sorts of other ways. And so Corsi is now in the position, if this case sticks around, of having to decide between getting it dismissed or subjecting himself to all sorts of questioning that otherwise he could refuse.
Speaking of ill-fated litigation gambits, let's talk about Michael Avenatti and his client Stormy Daniels, who've had quite a bad week. Long-suffering federal judge James Otero issued an order granting President Trump most of the attorney's fees he was seeking from Stormy Daniels. Trump had won what's called an anti-slap motion, a kind of motion that is intended to prevent so-called strategic lawsuits against public participation. If somebody sues you for defamation because you expressed a constitutionally protected kind of speech, such as an opinion, you may be able to file this motion and a judge might not only throw out the lawsuit against you, but also award you reimbursement of your attorney's fees for all the trouble. In this instance, President Trump had expressed some crude and negative opinions about Daniels on Twitter, as is his constitutional right, and she sued him for it, which was a mistake. Trump filed a motion for over $300,000 in legal fees incurred responding to Daniels' lawsuit, and Otero awarded him three-quarters of what he had asked for there. So, Ken, is Michael Avenatti a good lawyer?
You keep coming back at me with that one. So
yeah, I'm increasingly seeing evidence that he is not a good lawyer.
Well, he is not a good lawyer in this series of cases regarding President Trump. He is not acting like a good lawyer. So there are many components to being a good lawyer, and someone can be great in some of them and terrible in other of them. And it's increasingly clear he's used very bad judgment in this set of cases involving the president. I won't, he's had successes in other cases, big ones, so clearly he has some competence. His written work demonstrates competence, but he's shown terrible judgment. And to that extent, at least for the sake of his client, Stormy Daniels, he is not a good lawyer.
He actually got a bigger award against him, or she did, I should say, because really it's she who owes the money, than you predicted. You thought that Judge Otero was going to knock off, half of the legal fees that that Trump had asked for or more. Instead, he awarded him most of the fees. What do you attribute that to?
Well, other than me being dumb, it was an easy mistake to make, I'd say, because it is a very, very big attorney fee demand. And yes, Judge Otero awarded 75%. I was guessing somewhere between a third and a half. And the way he got there is interesting. He basically said that Trump's lawyers' hourly rates were reasonable. The number of hours they spent were a little too high for several reasons. But he really made it clear that he thought that the reason that Trump's lawyers had to spend so much time was because of the way Avenatti drove the case. So I think this is largely in Michael Avenatti's lap. You know, we've talked about throughout this, how does your public behavior interact with your fortunes in the courtroom? And here's one, I think, where this number that got approved is driven to a large extent by Michael Avenatti being Michael Avenatti.
Is it possible that Michael Avenatti is such a bad lawyer that Stormy Daniels might be able to sue him for malpractice over this? Because, I mean, you say this is in Michael Avenatti's lap, but really it's in Stormy Daniels' lap. She owes these legal fees. But did he engage in professional malpractice here by bringing this lawsuit in the first place?
It depends on what he told her. So a good lawyer would have told her, look, you can sue him for this, but I think there's a high chance that this will get knocked down on an anti-slap motion and you could wind up paying his attorney's fees, which could be vast. So go into it knowing that, but there's still a chance we could win. That would be competent advice. But if he didn't tell her that, then that's not competent. And if he did not sufficiently warn her of the risks, if he did not sufficiently tell her of the chances that she would lose, then yes, that could be malpractice. Now, recall that a couple of weeks ago, she was claiming very publicly that he filed this particular defamation case against her instructions. But then she sort of came back from that and seemed to indicate that she and Avenatti had made up and everything was hunky-dory. So I think practically speaking, if she sued him for malpractice, her inconsistent statements and behavior would be a problem for her. But absolutely, in this type of case, if you were coming in as her disaster mitigation lawyer, which is what she needs now, you would be looking very hard at what advice did Michael Avenatti give her.
So that's interesting. So I mean, she has not dumped Michael Avenatti as her counsel. They made up there, but this is sort of the time in the life cycle of litigation where it's time for the client to get rid of the lawyer and get a new lawyer who thinks about whether to sue the old lawyer. I mean, she's already doing that. She's already suing her previous lawyer, Keith Davidson.
Right. And it's kind of hard, frankly, to find a lawyer to sue the lawyer who was suing your previous lawyer, because we lawyers generally don't like to take those calls. We don't want to become lawyer number four on that chain of lawsuits. But very typically in this situation, you would be looking for new advice about how this went so wrong. It's particularly crucial for her because Michael Avenatti has been bragging about how clear it is to him that this anti-SLAPP ruling will be overturned on appeal. I think that is not correct at all. I think he has a very poor chance of winning on appeal. And if he appeals it, she can wind up on the hook for all of Trump's legal fees on appeal, which will be massive.
There was one bit of good news, though, in this order from Judge Otero, which is that the Texas law that governs this ruling, and it's Texas law for some complicated reasons, but basically it's because Stormy Daniels is a resident of Texas. Trump was entitled to sanctions on top of the legal fees, but Otero only gave Trump $1,000 in sanctions on top of the legal fees. And the analysis here was kind of funny, right? It was basically that, you know, the point of the sanction is to deter the client and the lawyer from pulling this kind of thing again. But they appear to have been deterred from that because they're already trying to claw back all their other sort of similar litigation that could cause similar issues. So basically, Otero is saying they're not bothering me as much as they used to be bothering me. And that's a sign that the award of legal fees is working on its own.
Yeah, Josh, this was some serious judicial shade at Michael Avenatti. It was basically saying, well, he's already voluntarily dismissing a different defamation suit, and he hasn't followed through when he ran his mouth about other defamation suits. So kind of looks like he's scuttling away and he's learned his lesson. The end result is that the number doesn't get much bigger, but it's definitely a gesture of contempt that's got to sting.
Well, there is much, much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
One thing before we go this week, as 2018 winds down, I want to thank you for listening to this show. It's been really great to hear your feedback and your questions. And speaking of those questions, we're going to answer a bunch of them on the show on December 26th. So if you have lingering questions about the Mueller investigation, the president's legal troubles, impeachment, the age-old question of whether Michael Avenatti is a good lawyer, although I think we may have answered that question this week, please call our All the President's Lawyers hotline and leave us a voicemail. If you're a millennial and you're not familiar with what a voicemail is, that's where you call on the phone and there's a recording. It'll record your voice and you'll be able to be heard on the radio in your own voice. You can also tweet your questions to us at LRCKCRW, but audio is more fun, so please call us at 310-853-3514. That's 310-853-3514. Please get your questions in by Monday of next week, and hopefully we'll answer them on the 26th. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our associate producer is Rosalie Atkinson. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken White and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.